Hi, I'm Ashley Eicher.
I'm Hunter Kelly.
And welcome to an all-new episode of the All Our Favorite People podcast. Today we have, well, one of our favorite singer-songwriters and guitarists, Patrick Droney, is with us.
Yes, I mean, I really enjoy Patrick's music, but you love Patrick's music. I mean, it's a soul level for you.
It does hit me on a soul level. I found out about Patrick like back in 2018 when his first EP came out, self-titled EP, and it's just the soul that is in his music, the lyrics. I love it.
Well, and his new EP, State of the Heart, there's more synth sounds, there's saxophone on it. It's a little taste of where his head is at as he works on his first full-length album. And that's another thing, Ashley, in getting ready for this interview, like when an artist first comes out with an EP and it's, you know, or two EPs like Patrick has, and they're this good, you're like, oh man, they're, you know, so out of the gate, a talent. The thing is, Patrick has been making music his entire life, and the people that have mentored him, that he has studied under, it's just insane. I've never done an interview with an artist where they have done as much groundwork on discovering who they are and also their sound and music under these huge names. Like, there were so many times over the course of his life he could have released music, and the fact that he didn't and waited until he had something to say is just, I mean, that's why this music is so excellent.
I mean, you think about, he was on stage with B.B. King when he was 12.
I know. And James Brown, opening for James Brown. I mean,
it's insane.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Well, honestly, I feel like we should just get to it, because otherwise I'll start fangirling more. But you hear that enough in this conversation. Yeah. And Patrick's, he's just one of the nicest guys too. And I mean, just good, good people. I love when I see him around town. He's so nice. So we're just both big fans. I love that you're a big fan now.
I am a big fan. Well, I was with the EP. I remember going to see him live and just love his stuff. But getting to know him as a human being has been a real treat.
Yeah. So here he is, Patrick Droney.
Hello, Patrick.
Patrick, welcome. It feels like this has been a long time coming.
Very long. Yes. I love you guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like we wanted you back on at the beginning, but I'm really excited to have you on now because there's twice as much music to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Which is great with this new EP, State of the Heart.
Well, I mean, Patrick knows this. I'm a huge fan and have been from, well, really since 2018 when your self-titled EP came out. So yeah, it just feels like this has been a long time coming. And then I love every time I see you around the city. So, and I'm so excited to see all of the things that have been happening for you over the last couple of years. It's been pretty incredible.
Thank you. It's been a journey, but it's really feel like building blocks and things that happened organically and based off the music, which is, you know, the most important part in the conversation that the music is bringing. Yeah. I'm grateful. You know, moving here 4 years ago, you know, at that point I've been doing this for like, you know, 11 years, 12 years. This is like, it's, you know, it's a long journey to the beginning. And I feel like I'm finally at the beginning and I couldn't be happier.
Well, cause you grew up in Pennsylvania and started playing guitar at what, 7? Is that right?
Yeah. I was a young man playing the blues. You know, my dad was a guitar player and I just started kind of gigging by the time I was 10, and I was touring hardcore by 12. And it was just like kind of the one thing I honed in on, and I never stopped doing it.
Well, I listened to this interview that you said that you were playing casinos and opening for a bunch of different artists outside of Atlantic City. I mean, as a teenager, really, right?
Yeah, so we moved from Lancaster, Pennsylvania to right outside Atlantic City when I was in sixth grade, and which was a godsend looking back, because I did have this opportunity to start playing music out and play live. And, you know, I started getting these opening slots at the casinos. You know, for, you know, B.B. King would come through. Like, my first one was with James Brown, and like, you know, I was 12, and it was a really funny but awesome thing. And as a young man, getting to just kind of cut my teeth with my heroes, it was a great way to start.
So what was your interaction with B.B. King and James Brown like at 12? Because that's nuts.
Well, you know, those guys, you know, were in the end of their careers, you know, and it had a long, long history of just making it happen for themselves in a time of adversity. And, you know, I find that a lot of the older generation really just wanted to help lift up, you know, the next generation and pass the torch, especially B.B. King. He was a real friend to young musicians, and myself, no exception. I got to play a number of shows with BB and have, you know, some time just to talk about life and what it means to make music and to stick to the path. And he was always about like staying focused and keeping about the music and not getting distracted by drugs, by, you know, everything under the sun that, you know, in his career, in different times he was. So, I was just lucky to have mentors from a really early age, and also to really gain a reverence for the music that gave me the ability to do what I do, to have that context, you know?
Oh yeah.
Well, cause did you even really have a capacity at that point to understand what you were getting to be a part of in playing with your heroes like that at 12?
Yeah. You know what? I did, funny enough. Because I was such a nut about blues music and soul music. And like, I was fanatical. I mean, this was my religion, you know?
Yeah.
I won this Robert Johnson New Generation Award when I was around that time. And I got to go to Hazelhurst, Mississippi and, you know, meet Robert Johnson's son and grandsons and kind of be like a part of the lineage of the blues. And for me, like that was like meeting, I don't know, like a kid today meeting whoever their icon would be, but it was just like the biggest deal. So for me, I really understood. I would love to go back now as an adult and really understand.
Right.
But, you know, it was a special time, but really it's all been a conversation between me and my dad. So my dad really, like, that's our bond is music and guitar playing. And it was just kind of a way for he and I to stay close too. So it's all very woven into the fabric of who I am.
Who did your dad play for? I heard you mention in an interview that he'd performed as a session musician.
Yeah, he was like a session cat in Philly, in like the Philly soul kind of scene. So he, you know, some stuff with Bill Withers and kind of that Gamble and Huff.
Bill Withers?
Decided to become a doctor. He left music and went to med school in the early 70s. So he kind of, yeah, he just taught me like you can do anything you want to do. And I feel like I'm picking up where he left off on the music side. And he's still saving lives and being a hero. So, and we jam when I go home.
Wait, did he work with Harold Melvin in the Blue Notes, like with Teddy Pendergrass?
He didn't, okay. But it was that era.
Okay. Yeah. Teddy, TP, really, some favorite.
Well, because I feel like winning that award was a turning point for you too in music.
Oh, completely. That was, I'd say, like the go, like, let's go, you know, let's do this, because it also put me on a bit of a map. And, you know, blues is a more niche genre and it's a smaller kind of crew, but they really take care of their own. And I was able to just kind of really hit the ground running and just be able to go play. But at the same time, I was discovering how much I love songs. And so as much as I was really hitting the ground running as a guitar player, and I mean, I was a frontman, I was trying to sing, my voice was cracking, all this stuff, but you know, I was like, my dad would equally show me like the Eagles songbook and Joni Mitchell and Jackson Brown and Springsteen. So I kind of knew that it wasn't going to just be, you know, a blues thing for me. And I made a conscious decision around 16 to take the longer path, which is like, you know, I really want to be the guy telling a story and writing songs that, you know, it's not just about the guitar solo. And that, yeah. And I knew it was going to take living to do that. So fast forward to, you know, 2 years later, I went to NYU, went to New York, and just started kind of letting life hit me like a ton of bricks, as it does. And it all just kind of spiraled into serendipity into today. So it's been a long journey.
I mean, that's the thing Hunter and I always talk about with a lot of songwriters is like, you have to kind of live some life before you can write the songs that are really powerful and really connect.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you get lucky and you guess, but I found you got to tell the truth and you got to live it.
I mean, obviously, I feel like that's where one of my favorite songs, Brooklyn, came from.
Oh, yeah. That's just real life. That is real life. That is, you know, seventh between B and C and the Lower East Side, real life living.
Well, and I think that was probably really my first introduction to you. And it probably was because I think Virginia, who's your manager, who's a good friend of ours, I think about 2018, she had posted Brooklyn. And I was like, wait, 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 wait. And Stand and Deliver, probably. I was like, okay, wait, wait. Who is this Patrick Droney guy? And what is this song? And why do I want to play it on repeat? Like, and it probably for me was just, I think, growing up with soul and the blues too. Like, what my dad loved was Otis Redding and Lionel Richie and Aretha Franklin. And so that's a lot of what was playing around our house growing up. So I think that's probably for me what connected with your music. And it just had a very modern spin on all of it.
Well, it's like, I believe in tangible soul. I think like it's not always wrapped up in like a 12 bar blues package. It's just like, there's an intention when you come from soul music and blues music. And yeah. what is so good about those old records is like, they just felt it and they projected that feeling. And I do think like, because that's the foundation of kind of where I come from and how I make my music, you can recognize it, I hope. And then also, you know, I'm really into new modern technology and music and, you know, producing these records, I always try to put a modern spin onto a classic feel. That's why I tend to call this genre new classic, because there's a familiarity to something that came before, but also like looking ahead at what's to come. So it's kind of put me in this cool spot of like, I feel a lot of freedom making my records, because whatever that gap is my sweet spot.
Oh my gosh. I want to say with that, I really appreciate the saxophone on Where You Are. Who is it? Kenny, The Weeknd has Kenny G on his song right now. And so when I heard Where You Are with the sax, I was like, thank you, because I've really missed it, but it's a really dynamic. I mean, it adds so much to the song. So tell me about just tapping into that with Where You Are.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, look, saxophone is such an emotive instrument. It's like you are really pushing air. It is truly somebody's like breath. And so Where You Are is a song that I wrote in London last summer. And it's a song. John Green, me and John Green, and Justin Parker too. But you know, John is kind of my spirit animal. Like if anybody doesn't know John Green, look him up. I mean, he's been a part of some amazing records and has his own artist project as well. But he's a hero, and he's just such a good friend. But I literally bumped into him on the street in London. We didn't have a session, and we grabbed the cup of tea, and I said, "You're coming with me," and we ended the song. And yeah, as we were producing it, you know, via London, and at that time I was kind of building off the demo in quarantine right after we got off that tour back home in Pennsylvania. And it was really trying to perfect it. And kind of in the last 10 minutes of this production, this was right before we put it to bed, I just heard it. I was like, wait, saxophone. Yeah. And I'd never had sax in my music before, but you know, obviously like being a huge Bruce fan, like there's a synergy between Clarence and Bruce and way past Bruce, but I called my friend Kevin and I just said, man, can you throw this on? Like, gave him no direction really. Just like, what do you feel? And he gave me back that solo. And I was just like, all right, this is a new thing. So, you know, we're cutting the album now, and I promise you, there's a lot of sex.
Good. Thank you.
It's so funny, Hunter, you bring that up, because in that song, like when I think about even just the lyrics of that song and just this idea of like checking the weather every single day to see where that person is and someone having that kind of an impact on you. Cause I'm like, I've done that before. Like people that I've dated in the past and years later, I'm thinking about it. And I'm like, I don't want to reach out to you, but I'm still just going to check all the things that might remotely make me feel like I've connected. Yeah. So to capture that kind of emotion, then you bring the sax in. When I first heard that, I was like, you gotta be kidding me right now. Like, am I going to cry? Am I going to cheer? I'm just not sure.
Yeah. It's a special thing. I mean, it's an intimate notion that these simple little things that how we kind of keep tabs all we have is stay close to somebody. It's a really fascinating thing, but I'm grateful for Kevin Gatsby playing that sax solo for sure. Mm.
So watching the Right With You video, where did y'all go to the desert to do that?
Yeah, we went out to LA, and that was a kind of Joshua Tree and then River Lake vibes. Yeah.
Because that whole thing about like, I want to get right with you. I'd always heard that like in the concept of like, I want to get right with God. I'm from, you know, the South. I'd never heard that phrase used as far as like in a relationship. So where did that idea come from?
That song, faith is actually an interesting part of that song too. I mean, the first line is call it faith. And
yeah.
Then it's going away. And you know, however you decide to interpret that is totally up to you. For me, this was, there's so much behind you at any given time. And every day you try to kind of mend these pieces and find closure. And some things maybe you never get to really figure out between you and another person, but even the pursuit of that closure in like your actions and what you're doing in your life as a better person, whatever it is, like all these things to me are like just trying to get right with maybe your past self, with somebody who doesn't know you anymore. And I think like that just happened. Like I was just writing with my buddy John Stark, and I had this thing, this loop, the little bass arpeggiated thing going on, and I just sang that line, just like came out. And I want to get my heart right with you. I want to drive this car back to you. And like to me, I made a mood board that night of desert, like Springsteen, Tunnel of Love. this big grand, you know, journey back to somebody. And I was so proud of that video because it really was exactly what I imagined it would be when the night I wrote the song. Man, what a cool experience.
Again, you're really giving some great desperate looks in the video, some acting going on.
I've been brooding for a long time, you know?
What was your method for getting to that place of...
I did also want to kind of like expand my comfort zone with this too. Like what this era has taught me, you know, the pandemic era is like, I just want to be, and I've always wanted to be authentic, but more than ever, my authentic self and put myself in positions to really show up and emote outside of just music. So that also includes if it's a video, instead of being the third person, just telling a story and watching two actors play it out. Like, no, this is my story. I need to be in this video. I need to be the guy. So it was definitely like a little bit of a different thing for me, but hey, if I brooded well, I appreciate you telling me.
Yeah, great. Loved it.
What has the pandemic and just having to kind of step back been like for you? I mean, you talk about feeling like you're realizing you need to show up in different ways, but what has that been like for you?
Wow. I mean, it's been transformative for everybody I know. For me, I was supposed to be on the road this whole time. And being pulled off of that and kind of all the pillars that we all thought were kind of the things that you leaned on and that got you through the day, they just kind of fell down. And it was just like, all right, what do I really have? Who am I? What do I have to lean on? And for me, it was like, okay, like get back into like healthy exercises. Like I got really healthy. I got into mindfulness and meditation and I really focused on making my records. And if I can't go play live music, my job is to, you know, tell these stories on these records. And this is kind of, I think it pushed jumpstart this process of putting out this EP and getting the album done and, you know, just flip my mentality a little bit, but I don't know. I just feel more aware and awake than ever. And I feel more response. Like I have a responsibility as an artist, and like putting out a song like Glitter in this time was a really big turning point for me as an artist and a songwriter, where I felt even more of a responsibility to tell a story and to start a conversation, because, you know, what that song did with grief and people sharing their stories in a time where there's this kind of collective grief was just such an example of, hello, A&R, bye-bye, example of why I need to be continuing to do this.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you bring up a song like Glitter, and I remember hearing that song for the first time and that line of like, grief, it's like glitter. Wait, what's the next part?
Or the brush away.
Yeah, and hearing it described in that way, and I just don't think, at least in my lifetime, there hasn't been a point where the world was in this collective stage of grief. And we're all trying to figure out, okay, how do I function within this? How do I stay safe? How do I keep my family safe? I still want to see my people. There are, you know, a lot of loss for people with jobs and people they love. And obviously we've been in a crazy year with an election too, but like, there's just been so much loss. So I can imagine just the conversations that you've had with people, whether it's on Instagram or that they've messaged you, of how much the song has connected with them. Cause I think so often, like, we're able to just sort of disconnect from whatever is going on in the world because we're so busy. And instead we've all been hyper aware and hyper focused of what's going on, not only in our own lives, but in people around us.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I meant about the pillars, just kind of not being there, and it's a source content. You know, what are you left with? But people have been unbelievably honest and open to me. And at times it's a little overwhelming because I internalize it and I feel like I want to continue the conversation. So, you know, I look forward to, I have a few things in the works as to kind of create a bigger scale of a platform to talk about these things and use Glitter as, more of a philanthropic endeavor down the line. So it's been inspiring for sure.
I love that.
There's always somebody experiencing grief in your life. I mean, I sent this song to a friend yesterday who just lost his sister, and listening to it, there's something about it that there's a defiance against sadness in the song that I think is really powerful. Because I know when I lost my brother 3 years ago, there is a little bit of just a, I'm looking for signs that they're still there, still feeling their presence. And I love that it's festive. Like, Glitter is a festive thing, but it's also very messy. How did you come up with that idea to describe grief? Because it also seems to talk to the defiance of letting sadness just completely define this experience.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry about your brother. It's a defiance for sure. And the thing is, you know, grief, in my experience, has been, it's been, I've had my own versions of that for many, many years. And it's something that has defined me in a way, but it's also how I've handled it and what I've taken it and transformed it into. And, you know, with Glitter, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's your life is an art project. And it's this idea that how do you take the mess and make something beautiful out of it? And this all started with my friend Wayne Hector was in town from London. He's a brilliant writer. And we were spending a week, and my mom is a social worker, and she had texted me one evening when we were writing that, you know, one of the girls she was, you know, having a therapy session with, her, you know, experienced some loss with her boy. I think her boyfriend and her friend died in a car crash. Wow. And my mom was trying to figure out a different way to kind of approach the idea of, you know, really telling her about grief and how it's a process and it doesn't just go away, because that was kind of the big theme with this girl. She didn't understand why can't this just go away. So she brought in an art project to, you know, to kind of visually and tangibly go over this idea with her, and the glitter spilled on the floor in the session. And mom told her that that's just like grief, you know, that people are shining and the memories stick to you and you try to brush it off, but like they're always going to be a little bit left and under the right light. She sends me this text. I was like, Mom, what is this? This is incredible. Anyway, I thought it'd be a nice song.
Yeah, and, it really is.
And I brought it to Wayne and I said, brother, we have to write this. And then the next day we wrote it. And that happened to be the day that our friend Busby passed too, after we wrote the song. We didn't know that as we were doing it. So it just kind of was this cosmic thing. And it's been a really big gift for me. It's helped me deal with my own grief. And we all need these kind of like boxes to put things in, right? Like, how do I make sense of this in a way that's like tangible and maybe different? And I think this song has just been a different metaphor for people to put grief under a different light, you know?
I mean, just thinking about your mom, like just that moment of that glitter falling on the ground and her realizing like this is the way to describe that to her patient or to her client. Like, it's those just moments in life that just kind of hit you like that. Oh, I don't know why I started to cry as you were telling that story. So I'm going to take a second.
I think songs are, I look at them like fossils. I've always said this, and you know, I don't write them. I discover them. I brush them off. They've always been there. And like, there's this really incredible experience where you wake up one morning and you don't have this thing. And then you go to bed that day and you couldn't imagine living without it, this idea or this thought or this song. So I think that happens outside of music too. Like every day we have these things that we discover that I feel like were meant for us, and we can be conduits for greater conversations through that.
When I think about when you were on the road so much and obviously writing a ton, like how do you stay creative in that space? I mean, it might be, I don't know if it's easier now that kind of the world has shifted, but you're incredibly observant of people, especially in your writing. So it's like, it's really easy, I would think, to get distracted. So how do you stay creative?
Well, I feel like for me, it's like, I don't actually have a problem staying creative. Like I have to stop. It's actually about defining like space outside of music, outside of writing, to get back to like who I am as a guy. So like, you know, I wake up every morning and I play tennis now. I play tennis. Like it's silly, but for me, it's like these things that like actually are helping me in my creative departments, because I'm just able to like turn off the faucet for a second. Like I hope that lasts forever, and maybe one day that it'll slow down. But right now I just feel like, you know, there's this great book, The Alchemist. I don't know if you guys have read it.
Yeah.
But, you know, like the universe conspires in your favor if you're following your destiny, if you are where you're supposed to be. And I do feel like I am exactly where I'm supposed to be. Therefore, the gift of music and being able to make it is flowing. And I just, every day, I just want to lean into it, you know?
I mean, I love that you're playing tennis, because I started playing a couple of years ago, and and like 1 year ago, after like 2 years of lessons, I finally decided I was going to get serious about it. And really it started because I'm like, oh, I can have wine with the girls afterwards. And then now I'm actually attempting to be good. But like, how's your tennis game? Like, how do you feel about it?
Well, all right. I feel like I can get there fast enough. I probably look like an idiot. I'm no good, but I love it. Like me and my buddy, John, like he wrote Right With You With Me and The Wire as well. And he's one of my best friends. And we just decided like, we're going to play tennis. We're going to be tennis players. So we just go and like, we kind of meet each other where we are and just have fun with it. Like, to me, it's like a sneaky exercise because I'm just having a good time, but I'm like, oh wait, I like feel like I just worked out. So that's the best way for a guy like me to do that.
Okay. All right. That makes me feel a little bit better about my tennis game. So that's good.
Yeah, you're fine.
Yeah. But you know, turning the creativity off, I think that there was also a little bit of that going on when you decided, hey, I need to go live some life to write songs, because as much as you talk about the B.B. King kind of blues side, you're also steeped in, you know, the songwriting of the Eagles and Joni Mitchell and working with Danny Kortchmar. Is that how you say it? I know him as Cooch from reading books about James Taylor, and Glenn Ballard. So I'm wondering, is turning off the creativity, like you have to go take time to live some life to make the songs really?
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, at that point, like when I decided it was going to be a longer journey, it was also about ability. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, I wasn't ready. Like I didn't have the voice. I didn't have the perspective yet. I had the potential, mm-hmm. and I'm very lucky on my path to be, you know, you meet people who see potential, and, you know, in this day and age of instant gratification and wanting it now, it's a rarity to have to find people who want to cultivate talent or, you know, potential and just let you grow as a person. Mm-hmm. Some bumpers. So I was really lucky to meet, you know, my first publisher, Lance Fried, when I was in New York, who, you know, he ran Rondor Music, and his dad was Alan Fried, the great disc jockey who coined the term rock and roll. And Lance is my first publisher. He just gave me time and space. He just, you know, went to LA and he just, you know, gave me a place to write, time to hone my craft and the ability to, like, you know, meet guys like Cooch and, you know, Glenn Ballard and spend honest time just trying to figure it out. And even then I wasn't ready. All I was like, oh, this is it. I got, what is it? It never shows up. It is every day. Mm-hmm. It is here now. How can you be the best you can be today? And challenge yourself. So yeah, I just have such a reverence, for people who are great songwriters. And, but Nashville was really the turn. That was really when it was a match of, I was ready. I had something to say. And then I was around people who elevated that so much. And I mean, from the craft standpoint, you know, just to be able to walk into a room and be around amazing writers that made me feel like, I love feeling like the worst guy in the room. Like, I love it. I don't ever want to feel like the best guitarist, best writer, best anything. Like, put me on the lowest end of the totem pole and like, I want to rise up. Yeah. So that's what this song has really done for me. And, I'm really grateful for Nashville, for sure.
When you've got some, I mean, we've mentioned, obviously, John Green. I know you wrote with Sarah Buxton and Ian Fitchek, and they both worked on you in the first EP. But what was it like really finding, like, your tribe of writers to you to write with? I feel like that was probably a transformative moment for you, too, when you got to Nashville.
Oh, for sure. I mean, and it happened pretty quick. The same handful of people I write with are those people from that era. You know, Sarah Buxton being one of them, she's like my angel sister, and, you know, Ian and John Green, Gordy Sampson, you know, handfuls, too many to count really, but, it was like meeting your family. It was like meeting your like soul connection to these people. And then and the writing room is such an interesting place because it's like, it is so intimate. Yeah. You are walking in and you are spilling within 10 minutes, like the darkest, deepest, lightest, brightest parts of your soul. And finding common ground. So it was just like, it's one thing to move to the new place, right? And like try to make it home, but like they made it home, you know? And at that point, I came as kind of a left of center guy, you know, like I'm not a country artist, but I have a certain kind of foundation that we all connect upon. And like, I could see that they were inspired by what I was trying to do. And there was this kind of mutual respect and, yeah, gosh. And then of course, you know, I meet Virginia and I meet, you know, just everything falls into place because you're at the right time. You're doing the thing you're supposed to do. And I just can't believe it's been 4 years in Nashville. That's crazy.
When there really is something to be said, like when you're doing what you're supposed to be doing and what you were meant to do, things, it may not be in the timing you want, but things just fall into place. Like the people that are supposed to be in your life. I've seen this in my own life. Like the doors that are supposed to close will close and the doors that are supposed to open will open and the people that are supposed to be there will be there and they'll be champions.
Yes. It's a hard thing to remember in the moment when you have that impatience, when you have the doubts, when you see everybody else seemingly get ahead or whatever it is. But that's why this whole mindfulness thing is really important, to practice, you know, compassion and empathy, and like to be excited for others, and to like, because we're all the same thing. We're all the same person at the end of the day, just trying to do something with our lives. So like, I don't even know where I was going with that, but I certainly find that place between my limitation and my ambition, and try the best, like do the most I can. And then after that, just accept that like the universe is going to take over, and it does work out for sure. I'm definitely proof of like persistence is key.
Thank you guys so much for listening to the All Our Favorite People podcast. If you like what you hear, go check out the All Our Favorite People community on Patreon. That's patreon.com/allourfavoritepeople. And for as little as $3 a month, you can help us keep the podcast growing as we add live shows and events.
We're also offering you exclusive access into planning episodes, as well as off-the-cuff interactive bonus content that we just can't fit into the show. You'll find out who's coming on the show first and possibly get a shout out on the podcast.
I don't know why I wanted to laugh at you just then. Check it out on Patreon. That's patreon.com/allourfavoritepeople.
I think you're the first guest that we've had that is on a record with Whitney Houston. We talk about Whitney Houston all the time, but you have a song with Kygo on the Golden Hour record. So I'm fascinated by him because I went back and looked, but it was really the, what he's done with like Tina Turner, Donna Summer, like, you know, Whitney Houston, that's my sweet spot. So
that is our sweet spot. We love, Whitney, we could break into a Whitney song just about at any moment on this show.
And I'd watched that vocal for Higher Love was released in Japan in 1990. So I knew that it existed and loved her version, but just for him to make it a hit, it was freaking awesome. But yeah. So tell us about how you connected with Kygo and who he is and how that happens, because it's
you wrote the song.
Yeah. You wrote the song, but to connect with him, it just seems like some kind of international DJ phenomenon.
Yeah. You know, that's part of like, that's the crazy thing about music is it's like this connector, and it's so universal that, you know, a guy like me and a guy like Kygo could come together and do what we did on a record that has so many different types of things. I mean, I went out to LA to write for his record. I definitely wanted intentionally to write for Kygo. And, but I did so very like intentionally writing a Patrick Doherty song. Like because I knew that if this was going to be a thing, I'd have to stand by it and I'd be, you know, be proud of it, but also, you know, like it have to be me. Because so often you just kind of blindly write for other projects and stuff. But I wrote that. Yeah. So we wrote that like a year and a half ago. And then it was really the kind of thing where that happened the day of, and then a bunch of time passed. And it was one of those random days where like, oh, I think I'm on the Kygo record. I think we got But it was also like the top of the pandemic. And like, it was an interesting time to kind of have a win like that, because so many of us were like, well, what are we doing? Like, so we just got to put our heads down. And that's like an example of a lot of how we do this music thing is like, you just work hard and 2 years later that work shows up, or whatever it is. So you kind of just kind of keep going. But Kygo he's incredible. And I love, you know, his take on modern music, and he has a real reverence for what's behind him too. And he's an international sensation. I mean, geez, like just the reach of his fan base is incredible. And I'm grateful for that, because it's certainly put my music in different places around the world outside of the Kygo record. And it's just exciting. So yeah, it was an honor to be part of that project.
It's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I really just love you're on the same record as Whitney Houston.
Well, you know, it's funny. Like you said that, I'm like, wait, I am? I'm like, oh yeah,
you are. It's a fact.
That's crazy.
Whitney, the best.
Oh, man.
So you've got a Christmas song that just came out, All I Want for Christmas Is You, to Mariah Carey, which is completely reimagined.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. We're hitting both Mariah and Whitney. It's like the Prince of Egypt, When You Believe. Do you know that one? You know their duet, right, Patrick? Sure. Yeah. Yeah, duh. Oh, yeah. Can we sing that later?
We would sing that as a duet, too. No, but that song, I mean, this is one of the biggest Christmas songs of all time. Like, I feel like I know it's Christmas when that particular song starts playing and you hear Mariah Carey. You hear those first couple of notes and Mariah starts singing
it. It's like she's ready to attack. It's basically like there's memes now of like Mariah's getting ready for, you know, warfare of like this song attacking and being everywhere.
But how did you decide to record this song for Christmas?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, one of the most famous Christmas songs ever, if not also one of the best written pop songs I've ever heard. So, you know, when we did this, you know, Spotify singles, they've done this for a few years now. And, you know, the thing was, you can't pick any songs that have been done already. So as I was looking through the list, I was like, wait, nobody's done Mariah. And I was like, why? Well, I was like, oh, right, because it's Mariah. In my nature, I'm like, well, of course I want to do Mariah. Let's go do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, my thing was, I grew up, my dad's a huge Christmas music guy. Like, you know, it's like very early, we got Christmas music in the house. And I always find it to be really emotional, and it's nostalgic, and it brings me back to the times when everybody was still around. And, you know, so I was really excited to go in this endeavor to kind of flip one of these songs. This being such a big endeavor because it's Mariah, and like from many standpoints, I decided that the best way to do it was to kind of lean into that intention of like, what is this really about? And it's about like being with the one you love, you know, in these special times. And I thought, well, it's really soulful, and like, let's cut it into halftime and make it like a true halftime groove, and flip this and bring in the saxophone,
bring in the blues.
Yeah. You know, like it's 'cause it's just a soulful song. So wow, what a fun thing to produce that and to make it happen. I'm really honored that I was asked to do it, because I mean, that's the kind of music that really brings families together, and like those are part of special moments. So I'm excited about it.
Well, that's what I love when artists are able to take a song that we all know and love and completely reimagine it in a different way. And then you just fall in love with it from that perspective.
A lot of my favorite, you know, songs are like actually covers of originals, you know, like interpretation is pretty amazing. It's an amazing thing. And I love to see how people kind of decide to go this direction, that direction. Even with my own songs, you know, people covering my stuff. It's really fun to see like, oh, that's how you heard that. That's incredible. I wish I wrote it that way.
What are some of your favorite covers that someone has reimagined?
Oh man, you put me on the spot.
I know. Sorry.
You know what is a, is a, and this, I'm going old school here now though. Like,
please do.
I love Wilson Pickett's Hey Jude. I think that's so incredible. And Take Me to the River, Talking Heads. Like, you know, just there's a long lineage of artists, just, you know, and a lot of times those are records that end up making the artist's career. And I don't know what my cover is yet. Like, obviously I'm doing this song, All I Want for Christmas Is You, but outside of Christmas, I don't know what I do a lot. I do like Hungry Heart. I love doing Hungry Heart.
Oh man, that's a great song. Yeah.
Staple. But I think I'm still looking for my cover, like the thing that I'm going to do.
Well, and all the synth sounds on the State of the Heart EP, going back to Bruce, did take me back to, you know, Dancing in the Dark, which I've been, so at this point with vinyl, I've pretty much bought all the vinyl of my favorite artists. Like, I have the complete, like every LP they've done. So at this point, what I'm looking for is like the 12-inch remixes and extended remixes. So I just found the 12-inch single of Dancing in the Dark by Springsteen. So this whole record, and even going back to like the sax on Where You Are, is, oh yeah, this totally reminds me of when Clarence played with Gaga on Edge of Glory, you know, and it was such, yeah. So I just love the synth sounds and everything.
As much of a guitar player as I am, I am equally inspired by textures. And mm-hmm. a lot of my favorite music I found from TV and film, and mm-hmm. cinematic feelings can be kind of conjured up in music. But you know, like Don Henley and like Clapton, and like that's what I'm talking about. Like, that's what I'm going for. And, you know, those guys, it was all about this kind of this air underneath the music. And that was all those pads. Mm-hmm. And it just, when anybody who's written with me will tell you, they walk into my room and I already have a pad, like a drone, just in the background. It's like you're walking into a spa. Because vibe. Like, I'll find the key of the song, I'll put it on a pad. And I mean, they don't call me a droney for nothing. I'm like a drone guy. But it's
oh my gosh, you mentioned, you mentioned Don Henley, and it makes me think of the Eagles. And like the second or third concert I ever went to was the Eagles Hell Freezes Over tour.
Oh,
and I was
incredible.
I was in high school, I think, and I was obsessed. Like my first concert was Ray Charles. I think the second,
my number one, you know, Ray's my number one.
Did I tell you that? Is he?
He's beyond anybody in the world. And it's Ray Charles. He's the top of the top for me.
I love this because I love Ray Charles. That was my first concert and I went with my grandparents. So it's like a very sweet memory anyway, especially since they've been gone for a couple of years. But the second was New Kids on the Block, which I sometimes claim or don't claim.
Oh, why would you not claim that all the time?
I mean, I did have the button. I had the whole thing.
Listen, we watched A Hard Day's Night the other day and my boyfriend Clint was all like, oh, the Beatles were totally like the original boy band. I was like, yeah. So it's no shame.
It's such, you know what? Thanks, Hunter. I appreciate that. But the third one was the Eagles Hell Freezes Over tour. And I just remember being in that arena, just like, I loved every song on that record. I still do, but just how unbelievably talented they were. And just those songs, like I could probably sing every single one of them back right now.
Oh yeah. And I would just like devour the DVD of that. Like that's what I would watch at home, Hell Freezes Over DVD. And I mean, like There's a Hole in the World Tonight. Some of the songs are just like unbelievable. And I mean, that's just the height of, I think, like also a group of people who play music for a long time together with all the contention that comes with it. But like they did come back for this like really beautiful moment in time. But yeah, special stuff.
What was your first concert outside of one that you played?
B.B. King.
Okay.
Keswick Theater in Pennsylvania. I was so excited that I had an asthma attack in the aisle walking down.
How old were you?
Oh God. Nine?
I don't mean to laugh. We don't mean to laugh at you having an asthma attack. You were so excited.
I definitely hyperventilated at shows. Like I get it, you know.
Oh, yeah, I was so pumped, but that was the first time I met BB too. He went back into his bus, and I have a picture of the first time we met, and just so warm. So I was thinking this morning actually about how there are so few left of that generation. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it's like I was thinking about Buddy Guy this morning. He's still around, but. You know, like it's sad, but it's beautiful. But yeah, I just feel lucky to be in those times. Anyway, I get sentimental quickly.
Well, I mean, we get that because we both get sentimental. I mean, like as you were talking about that, I met Stevie Wonder once and I grew up just loving him. And somebody was asking me the other day, like, do you have a photo? I was like, I have a photo of the back of my head, like shaking his hand. Cause I literally, this is when I was working at Creative Artists Agency and I just got like a last minute invite to the show and went backstage and I had to convince my friend that was an agent who typically refused to take photos of anything. I was like, I don't care. Like I need you to take this just for like the 10-year-old girl in me that has loved Stevie Wonder my entire life. And I just need to have this. Like I'm not being cool anymore. I don't care.
You know what I love though? And I've always held on to is like, and obviously it's different in today's age, but handshake for me was always so like, special because it's like you're touching history and like, you know, that hand created that music. And like, I'm always, you know, whenever I take a picture, I'd like always get a picture of the handshakes. It's so special. Cause like, I don't know, it's kind of a very tactile part of the memory, but that's special. It's great stuff.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Don Henley because in The Wire, I did notice your use of the phrase Heart of the Matter, which is one of my favorite songs of his.
Same.
Oh, oh gosh. Like, you know, working with Danny Korchmar, who produced some of those Don Henley solo records was like super influential in my really the dissection of how those records were made and what went into them. But oh my God, like in a New York minute, yeah. I mean, these are just timeless classics, but I had to do a little bit of a nod to Don in that song.
So funny. I got my mom the latest Eagles Blu-ray of the Forum. So it's like the new version with like Deacon Fry and Vince Gill playing. Yeah. Of course, my parents love Vince and they love the Eagles. So it was great. We could not get that Blu-ray to work in their Blu-ray player and it was not available digitally. So we had to go back and watch the other DVD I bought for them in 2004 of Live in Australia, the Melbourne, the Farewell One tour. But it was so funny because I guess they really gravitate towards all the 70s stuff. And then for me, it was like when Henley would do his 80s stuff, or Glenn Frey would do You Belong to the City, that's when I would perk up. I was like, oh yeah, okay. For some, this is just speaking to me right now.
How about Vince playing with the Eagles, man? That's so cool.
I know, right? It's crazy.
It makes perfect sense.
It does.
He's somebody who, when I first got to town, I went up and played with the Time Jumpers. And Vince, one of the most, like, a tell of a really great person is if they give you their instrument to play. Mm. You know, this is like, your guitar is your guitar. Like, it's mine. Mm. And he just gave me his 335, sat on the side of the stage and just let me play. And that was something like I will forever remember that from Vince Gill. Really sweet man.
It's so funny you mentioned Vince, because some friends and I were, a friend of mine is a songwriter, Topher Brown, and our friend Scott were having lunch yesterday. And we started talking about Vince Gill and just how he is the kindest person in Nashville. He and Amy both. And just the way they give back to this community and love songwriters and musicians. And just an example of that. I think Topher had his own example. I mean, I think for Hunter and I, when we had Amy and Vince separately on the podcast,
they've both been on the show separately.
Yeah. And they were both like, hey, do you just want to come to the house and record this? And we were like, I mean, sure.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I grew up singing every Amy Grant song. So I was just like, oh my gosh, Amy's invited us to their house.
Love her so much.
I'm not going to be cool today. But I just think about examples like that. You just said of just how generous they are.
It matters. And like, you know, those little moments stick with people forever. And like, you know, that's why it's just important at any stage of the game, you know, to be learning and teaching. You know, we all have something to teach somebody and we all have something to learn. And I certainly try to like maintain a mentor mentality to kids that I know that are coming up, and also just like soak up everything I can from people who, you know, can teach me stuff. So.
When you talk about mindfulness, what are some of the things that you're doing?
So there's this kind of crazy notion. It's not crazy. It's awesome. It's called radical acceptance. And it basically means like, if you cannot change the circumstance, if you accept everything as it is, just like baseline, we often, you know, pain is unavoidable, but suffering is optional. And we kind of decide to go deeper into these rabbit holes of things that we can't change. And that's kind of, I think it's avoidable. So I just try to take everything that I see for what it is. If I can do something about it, I don't worry, because it's kind of the illusion of progress. I plan. I try to figure out what can I consciously do to make a difference here. And if I cannot do anything, I accept. So I'm also back in school right now. I'm finishing my degree at NYU.
Congratulations.
I left for the semester left 7 years ago. And I decided at the time I would just jump back in and finish my degree. And one of these classes I'm taking is a psychology class on mindfulness. And it's been a really amazing thing. You know, every Friday I'm in this class for 3 hours and just like really diving in with some of like the most intense, like smart minds on mindfulness and meditations and stuff like that. And it's been really transformative for me. So I don't really like talk about that, because it's like kind of just a personal thing. I'm just getting some closure and finishing this degree, but I feel like that was a huge part of why I was meant to do this right now, is because it's helped me shape some stuff up here, you know, that I'm trying to implement into my music and my creativity and, you know, just being a well-rounded person.
I love that. Awesome. It's funny you bring that up, because it's like, I downloaded a couple of apps, to be honest, on mindfulness and the Calm app, and just getting outside for me and taking a step back and just trying to center, especially in the last 8 or 9 months, to just kind of regain, I think, some sanity. It's been so helpful.
Yeah.
And honestly, just, really transformative.
It's gratitude too. It's just like taking a second, going outside, even just a breath under the sun with the true acknowledgement that you are here right now and alive is enough. That's being mindful. That's practicing it. And if that's all you can do in a day, it is good for you and you should do it, you know? Because this thing, this cell phone, is like the bane of my existence. It takes me out of every moment. It's like this constant thing. So I've been trying to leave my phone at home a little more too, when I go out for a walk or, you know, go play tennis, just like don't even bring it with me, because it's kind of this pull into that stress land.
Well, and even I think about just this season, like if there's anything that I've learned, it's about being present with either in where I am right now or just with my people, like having really great quality time with people that I love. Whereas opposed to before, I would be running from event to event to event or trying to go see this person or do this thing. And I think this season of just having to stop, I'm like, wait, this is the stuff that really matters to me. And I find myself going to sit by a fire with friends. I'm like, I haven't looked at my phone in 3 hours.
Right.
And what a gift that is.
Mm-hmm. It's you recognize how much of a conveyor belt we were all on.
Yeah. And
it's this illusion of just like, go, 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 go. What were we really doing? So conscious time, we have conscious time. And it's like, how are you going to spend it?
One of your mentors in LA was Glenn Ballard. So he fascinates me because I remember being like a kid and he was Wilson Phillips' producer. So in my head, he's doing all this like pop Sheen stuff. And then, which I love to this day, I freaking love Wilson Phillips. Saw him at the Wild Horse Saloon like 2 years ago and it was just heaven. But then he did Alanis Morissette, which was like so jagged. Little yeah. Peel. It was, you know, so I'm just, you know, he was the first person that I saw was like, wow, can really put on these two different hats for me. Like looking at him, it was a moment of like, oh, wow, I thought you did one thing and now here you are doing a completely different thing. So I'm just wondering, like, what was your experience with him like and how did he influence you musically?
Glenn is a true Renaissance man. He is somebody who has his hands in so many different things as a composer, as an arranger, as a lyricist, as a, you know, he just put out a show on Netflix called The Eddie. And he's got on Broadway with Alan Silvestri. And this man is just such a true creative. And for me, it was just, he was the first guy in LA to really just take me under his wing and work with me and just write with me and believe in what I was doing. But it was, for me, it was just about like, okay, how do you reinvent yourself as many times as Glenn has? I mean, it's just one of those things that has this constant drive for the next thing. He could have stopped making music a while ago.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But that taught me a lot. And in that time, it was me, him, and a pianist named Randy Kerber, who is John Williams' pianist. And Randy, you know, he's playing the theme on Forrest Gump's Feather and Harry Potter. He's the guy playing the piano. Randy's a brilliant guy. But it was just this time of I was like around these unbelievable minds from like arrangement standpoint and composition standpoint. So, you know, again, I wasn't necessarily ready to like do my thing yet, but those guys set another foundation. And, you know, they're still some of my closest friends, and Glenn and I speak often. But it's more about the idea that like there's so much to be done and you should have your hand in everything and try. That's for me, like the production side of what I do, making these records, has so much to do with guys like Glenn, you know, inspiring me to also say, hey, you should produce, you should do this, you know, be more than just the guy who's singing the songs. You should make the records. So again, just another person whose shoulders I'm definitely standing on.
The first single from Wilson Phillips' second record, Shadows and Light, You Won't See Me Cry, was not a big hit, but I still listen to it all the time. And it has the most luxurious saxophone solo you ever hear.
Honestly, I cannot wait for you guys to hear the album.
Good.
I am ready. I've already had the EP on repeat, so you know I'm ready for the full album. And I feel like we're just getting teasers on Instagram.
You are. I'm in the studio right now, so it's like I'm just real time sharing the stuff, but I'm so excited. So excited.
Hunter, do you have another question?
I do. So I heard you also mention Danny Kortchmar was in that whole group with James Taylor, Jackson Browne, but also Joni Mitchell. So Joni, for me, is one of those artists that I keep going back to and discovering more of. And I'm wondering if it's what's your journey with Joni Mitchell like?
Oh, man. My first introduction to Joni was just the whole Blue record. Mm-hmm. That honestly would have been enough just to sustain me to today. It's just such a unbelievable piece of work. But for me, Joni was more about like the way she heard melody, mm-hmm. and the way that she constructed like the arrangements of these songs using that instrument she was playing. And I forget the name of it. Do you know what it's called? She'd sit down
the auto harp kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Joni to me was always more of like an innovator. Like somebody who did not need to fit a mold, mm-hmm. To become really a pop like sensation. Like pop music is just popular music, but you know, I actually was able to meet Joni Mitchell in Laurel Canyon a couple years ago.
What?
We had was at a dinner and she was in this flowing long dress. And I was just like, that's Joni Mitchell. And when I make my Joni Mitchell cover record, I'll call it Droney Mitchell.
Thank you. Well, I have some, please include some tracks from Hajira, but dinner with Joni, I can't even breathe right now. I mean, she's so pivotal. Basically I picked my therapist because she reminded me of Joni Mitchell. So
I love this about you, aren't you?
Oh my God. So what did you say to her?
That's just more like a thank you for everything.
Yeah.
And just have a lovely night. You know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah. Joan. Oh man. I think about her all the time.
Hunter is going to talk about this in particular for weeks.
Yeah.
I'm going to be going on a Joni kick today.
Yeah. I'll call Ann Powers is working on a book about Joni Mitchell right now. So I text her all the time of like, hey, I just had a breakthrough with Song for Sharon from the Hajira album, you know, that kind of stuff. So yeah, I can't believe you met her. I'm freaking out right now. Whitney Houston and Joni Mitchell. You're just connected to everybody.
And yeah. Mariah.
Yeah, let's go. Well, you know, Mariah's got the glitter connection too. Like I'm just, you know.
Well, and I love that she's reclaimed glitter because that record is, there's some great 80s moments on that record. And it was a victim of bad timing, but that record is solid.
I mean, before we wrap this up, Patrick, how are you I know you've done a live stream recently for the new EP, which was really great, by the way. It was so funny because watching it, which let's be real, I rarely watch those, but it was funny watching it. This is how, again, I'm just a fan, but seeing so many friends of mine in there within the business, I'm like, this is how you know that people are really engaged with you when you've got a ton of music industry people who are typically pretty jaded, literally fangirling in the middle of a live stream for an EP.
That's awesome.
So that was actually kind of fun. I was like, we are total music nerds right now. But, you know, how have you sort of fed that live creative, you know, part of you? Because you haven't really been able to perform live in months.
Yeah, honestly, I haven't. So it's one of those things that we went in and we did a live stream for the EP, and that was a great experience because we just had finally all gotten back together and were able to play. But with that said, it was like I was playing stuff we hadn't played before because I've been making these records off the road and we haven't been able to be together. But that's what you will hear in the album, because I'm cutting it now, is a real energy of the band, because we are in the room together, you know, safely right now, taking nothing for granted and playing music at the same time and pushing air through these microphones. And I think that will be the legacy of this time in my music, as far as like, where did the live thing go? Well, it went back into the music. Cause it's so easy to make these records, you know, mobily. And for me, because I can, you know, put my blinders on and make all these sounds and have a kind of a done song without even a person playing on it. Like, it was a great reminder that we are the best when we are together and making music and having that conversation. So you'll hear it in the album for sure.
Well, and it just goes back to us talking about just gratitude. Like, I don't think we realized what we've had until we haven't had it.
Completely. And I take nothing for granted anymore.
Yeah. Yes. I love it.
Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh. Thanks so much for being here. We loved it. Come back anytime.
I remember 2 years ago, like more than that, when the EP was kind of starting to go, and Ashley posted a story. And I was like, she seems really cool.
Thanks so much. I feel like we keep saying this and you know it, but there, when, you know, it's like Hunter's the same way. It's like when we find artists that we really connect with the music and just like them, that's just it.
And I went to see you at Exit Inn, and I just, you know, and that's the thing, I have to go to the stuff for work. Like, you know, sometimes I'll actually say, God, I hate, you know, just as a joke, like, I don't like music, you know, just because you get so now. But yeah, I really enjoyed seeing you play live. And it's one of the weird things of like this time that, you know, this happens over and over again now with all the interviews that we do. It's like, I can't wait to hear these songs live.
Yeah, we'll get there. Having a platform for a real conversation and digging past the surface. And this has been lovely and inspiring to me. Yeah. So thank you.
Well, we loved it. Come back anytime.
One last
it's
thing.
It's great to see your face.
You mentioned Will Jennings, and he wrote a song that will never get over. I'll Never Love This Way Again by Dionne Warwick. Do you know that one?
Yes.
Okay.
Come on. You're like, we gotta hang. I gotta see all these vinyls and the.
You know, oh yeah. Oh, we would have fun. Oh. Like the YouTube. Actually, for Christmas, I'm getting a mixer so I can go between turntables because I've got all these 12 inches, and I'm like, some people have, like, I guess, sold a lot during quarantine and stuff. So I've just got all this amazing 80s and 90s dance mixes, and I'm just like, oh, I need to just play.
Awesome. That's awesome. I'll enjoy
yeah.
it.
Well, let's hang, dude. It's good to talk.
Yeah.
Okay, so exactly how many times did we talk about me being a fan in this episode?
I mean, it was throughout, but I feel like you are the person out there listening who's going to discover, you know, you're standing in for them of like, oh my God, I love you, Patrick. we did say in this episode, the Beatles started out as a boy band with like screaming girls. So, I mean,
yeah,
it's a great place to start.
You know what? There are worse places you could be.
Yes.
So, but we really did. We loved having this. We loved this conversation. Patrick, thank you so much for being on the show. Come back anytime.
For real. There's so much more to talk about.
I can't wait for us to all hang out and explore your record collection.
Yeah.
Because it's extensive.
Well, especially once I get this mixer and I can like go from, between my two turntables, the sky's the limit.
You know, I've got to buy a record player. That's where I'm at going into the holidays. I'm trying to find a really nice one.
Oh, I have suggestions offline.
Honey, I know you do. I know you do. Oh, you guys, make sure to go find Patrick's EP, State of the Heart. Be on the lookout for his debut album that will come out next year. I also would tell you just to go to his page on whatever your streaming service is and just put it in your library.
Yeah.
Every bit of his music. Just do it.
Add it because it's quality.
That's where I live. You can also find him on social media. You can find us at All Our Favorite People. You can find me at Ashley Eicher. You can find Hunter at Nashville HK. You know, if you get a gander, maybe just rate, review, and subscribe. We would love it.
Please.
Did I say gander? I really said that.
Take a gander. If you get a hankering, you can take a gander. Take a gander, right?
Sure. I need to ask.
Go take a gander at our official page on Apple Podcasts and rate, review, and subscribe.
You can tell that it's the end of the day for both of us right now, and we're a little slap happy. Anyway, you guys go check Patrick out. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next week.